Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Allison Acosta Winters, a Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at Americans for Prosperity, as well as Senior Advisor at the Penn Wharton Budget Model and Economist Mom, Diane Lim. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Senate Appropriations Committee is lagging behind its desired rapid pace of approving 4 spending bills each week to close out September by getting through all 12 appropriations bills. Senate leaders thought there was a clear path ahead, but appropriators only approved 2 bills last week. 2 of the bills were pulled over an expected clash on policy riders. This week, appropriators only have 3 bills on the docket because the 4th that was planned is expected to have a partisan fight over border wall funding. So, even with a bipartisan 2-year agreement in place, Congress is struggling to pass each of the required bills and seems unlikely to do so before the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. In order to avoid another government shutdown on October 1st, a short-term stopgap measure will be needed, and steps are already being taken to pass a continuing resolution extending current funding levels through late November. But even the stopgap measure or continuing resolution that is being drafted in the House picks political fights. It may be held up by haggling over extraneous policy provisions and funding adjustments, known as anomalies, as well as additional aid to farmers to offset tariffs and extension of expiring health care programs. The House had previously passed 10 of its 12 spending bills on party lines, while the Senate waited on starting the process until after new overall spending levels were set by the budget resolution. Now, elected leaders are in a mad dash to the finish. The Trump administration has lifted its freeze of nearly $400 million in aid to the Ukraine, which had been held up for special review. The release of the funds followed bipartisan outrage over the move. The Congressional Budget Office weighed in on a House bill aimed at saving Social Security for the long term and found that it would only extend the program's solvency by 9 years. It differed greatly from the Social Security Administration's own finding that the same proposal would make the program solvent through 2093. CBO had different assumptions than the Social Security Administration in terms of life expectancy and disability rates. The bill would expand Social Security benefits and increase taxes supporting the system. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Advisor at the Penn Wharton Budget Model Diane Lim will join me to discuss the Economist Mom's new role and the work of PWBM. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Economist Mom and Senior Advisor at the Penn Wharton Budget Model, Diane Lim, and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Diane, you may remember as the Economist Mom, but it has been a while since we've had her back on the show. She now advises and guides PWBM on matters related to public outreach, communications, business development, and strategic planning. She has spent her 30-plus year career in a variety of prominent roles in the federal government, nonprofit, and academic sectors like the Congressional Budget Office, House Ways and Means Committee, House Budget Committee, as well as the Concord Coalition, the Pew Charitable Trust, Brookings, the Urban Institute, and the Conference Board. She has an amazing amount of experience. She also teaches behavioral economics and tax policy as an adjunct professor at George Washington University in Georgetown. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Diane and Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
Well, I'm certainly glad to have the Economist Mom back on the show. It was too long of a hiatus, but you had some pretty exciting life experiences and milestones take place in your absence. So why don't you give us a quick summary, Diane, of what's been going on in your life and what you're doing with the Penn Wharton budget model now?
Yeah, I got married to Brookings economist Bill Gale, and I then went on a lovely family honeymoon with all of our six adult children and their significant others, and then I came back to D.C. after a week of being away, and I had a change in job situation where I needed to find a position where I could do a lot of different things that I'm interested in doing. And when you work for a for-profit consulting firm, it's not so easy just working on whatever you care about. So this was an example. My doing this Concord Coalition radio show was one example of something that didn't actually count as work for the consulting firm. So I decided, yeah, I should find a job where these things, this engagement with the public and with other, you know, partnering with other nonprofits who care about fiscal sustainability, where that kind of thing would be encouraged instead of discouraged. So I got lucky, and Kent Smetters, who's the founding and faculty director of the Penn Wharton Budget Model Group, which is based at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Kent had been a colleague of mine dating back to the 90s at Congressional Budget Office. His first job out of his PhD was there. And so the two of us had worked together on models, on economic models, back in the 90s for CBO. And Kent was looking for someone to come help him take Penn Wharton budget model to the next level, which is that they and are a research organization based within Penn. They had been started about 3 years ago, and they were very much like a startup business in the sense that, you know, Kent had this idea of building a really sophisticated model of the federal budget and the economy, and using it to better inform policymakers about the trade-offs in policymaking as they were formulating policy ideas, rather than, you know, having to wait for the official CBO score, Joint Committee on Taxation score. And so Kent focused on creating that model, building a team that was almost entirely a technical team, you know, building a team of computer scientists and coders and statisticians and economists, very technical economists, computational economists, to build what I think is, you know, really a very state-of-the-art, cutting-edge micro simulation integrated with macro, long-term macroeconomic model. It's the most sophisticated model that I've ever seen in terms of having everything going on in it, being able to not just model these very different things, but have those different economic, different types of economic analysis talk to each other. So Kent had gotten the organization to the point where it had this amazing model, but it's like we're at the more mature stage of a startup's life cycle now, where the organization is ready to take the product to market more and to take it, you know, to kind of live out its carry on its mission, which if you read the mission, it sounds like it would be a very public-facing tool, this sophisticated model. They've grown from, you know, Kent and one or two other people at the start to, I would guess, maybe more like 15 a year ago, and now they're over 30. I was brought on to start connecting, engaging more with people on the Hill and in the executive branch and with other nonprofits that work on public policy engagement, and also to start communicating the research that Penn Wharton Budget Model does in a more accessible way so that the general public, a more lay audience, can actually understand it, because the stuff is very dense.
Well, right, I can give you a practical example. You know, the Concord Coalition is releasing 5 papers on various economic policy challenges like workforce growth and workforce training and healthcare reform and Social Security. For us, it's kind of like the next step is, okay, we think all this is going to help the economy, but, you know, really, realistically, what could one expect this would do for the economy in a policy sense if it was enacted? And so what might do, I mean, this is like just throwing stuff at the wall right now. We don't have any of it scored. So for the Concord Coalition, an interesting part of this is we really need somebody to go through these papers and say, well, maybe it could be refined in this way, or this isn't going to get as much as you think, or whatever.
Right.
And you look at that across the board. There are other organizations that do stuff like that, and certainly there are members of Congress that are developing policy proposals, and it does help. You're not going to be able to get CBO to score things. So having a resource like Penn Wharton is very valuable.
Right. And that's our, the mission is to work with not just sitting members of Congress, but also anyone that comes up with a good policy idea that they want to get some feedback on.
Those who are intellectually honest about their proposals.
Well, so this is how Penn Wharton Budget Model works, is that, institutionally, we are not for hire. We're not like a consulting firm in that people can't just pay us to do something and then we do it for them and they decide whether they're going to release it or not because they bought it. If someone comes to us and says we want an analysis of our proposal, we're not being paid to get a certain answer. We're going to be very objective and we're going to work with that person or that organization to provide them feedback on what are some of the maybe unintended economic consequences of certain feature aspects of their proposal that they may want to fine-tune. We would want any organization that releases our estimates as part of their showing, highlighting the proposal to the public, to also say that they had this analyzed by Penn Wharton Budget Model. And then they have to be kind of proposals that our models can handle. So they can't be really in the weeds proposals. They can't focus on, we only have certain levers in the economic model, even though we have a lot more detail than most economic models do. So they have to be kind of big policies because we have a very long-term model as well that is really good at picking up, for example, the adverse effects of debt on economic growth. Like that is like basically the biggest driver of long-term economic growth is national saving. And because federal government debt has such a big effect on overall public plus private savings rate, the biggest driver of long-term economic growth tends to be, are you deficit financing it or are you financing it and are you financing it with tax increases or spending cuts along the way, right? Because it's a huge disadvantage in a long-term economic growth model.
A deficit finance tax cut can goose up the economy in the short term, but over the longer term, it's going to catch up to you.
And that's what the model shows, right? So our model is not good, though, at capturing short-term stimulus policy because it's primarily a supply-side model that looks at how the economy evolves over the longer term in terms of labor supply and capital. The labor supply issue is why it's a great model to study the effects of immigration, because immigration is a very supply side issue, because you're boosting the primary economic effect of immigration is to boost the supply of labor to the economy. And that takes a while, though, to play out, right? Because immigrants come in and join the workforce, but then immigrants have children. So you really only see the full blossoming of these long-term positive economic effects of immigration over long periods, generational periods of time. You know, there's often a pushback that focuses on short-term economic effects, which is like, oh, well, immigrants will come in and they'll steal jobs from native-born Americans, or they'll have too many claims on government programs. You know, they'll cost too much to take care of in the short term. And so those kinds of arguments can only be pushed back with the longer-term analysis that shows that over the long term, there's really hardly any kind of policy, public policy, that would do more for long-term economic growth than increasing immigration, especially given the aging of the U.S. native-born population.
I want to jump back in and talk about the model a little bit more. But before I do, I just want to remind our listeners that this is Facing the Future. We're talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Senior Advisor at the Penn Wharton Budget Model and Economist Mom, Diane Lim. We're discussing Diane's work at PWBM. And I want to go back to something you said earlier on, Diane. I think this is all incredibly fascinating, this model itself and the level of detail and what you can use it for. But you also said it's one of the most sophisticated, if not the most sophisticated model you've ever seen or worked with. What makes it more sophisticated than, say, what CBO might use or what other known models are out there? And what are the advantages or disadvantages to that level of sophistication? I think you were getting into it a little bit in terms of, you know, short-term versus long-term perspectives and the levers that you can pull. But in terms of communicating all of this information to the public, what are some of those advantages or disadvantages?
The Congressional Budget Office has, you know, a long-term, they have a 10-year budget model that scores the cost of legislative proposals over a 10-year, which is the official budget window. They look at economic effects over that 10-year window. They also have a long-term outlook that they publish that goes out several decades, and their long-term model is based on a different sort of model than their shorter-term economic and budget model. And they also have distributional models, like occasionally CBO will put out a report on the distributional effects of the federal income tax system, for example, or the entire federal tax system, all the different taxes the federal government imposes. And that will look at the distribution of tax burden across households at different income levels. Typically, it's that's the distributional analysis, is by income categories. What's different about Penn Wharton budget model is we have all those capabilities. We can look over a 10-year window. We can do conventional economic and budget analysis over a 10-year window, very similar to what CBO does. We also have a much longer-term model that's called an overlapping generations model that has, you know, different generations going out. It can go out as long as you want, actually. It can go out into the long term, very far out, further than CBO's long-term reports go out. And the key is that our 10-year model can do both conventional and what are called dynamic estimates, which is estimates that take into account feedback effects on the macro economy. So if a policy, for example, cuts taxes, reduces the marginal tax rate, in the short term, that's going to reduce revenue. In the longer term, if it encourages people to work more and to save more, it will raise GDP over the longer term. Like, you know, after a year or two, you'll see it increase the size of the tax base, and therefore it can actually work to dampen the negative effect of just the marginal tax rate cut. That's called a dynamic effect in terms of the effect on the budget, because it's accounting for a change in GDP during the budget window. CDO does not do dynamic estimates except in the case of major policy changes, and then it's really the Joint Committee on Taxation that does a separate macroeconomic kind of score of the effect of major legislation that has more than, I think it's a 0.5% of GDP effect on the economy. And so Penn Wharton can do both conventional and dynamic scores over the 10-year window. They can do conventional dynamic scoring over a longer horizon. And we also have a micro simulation model that actually simulates household decisions at the household level. And so unlike CBO's distributional, well, similar to CBO's distributional models of taxes, which also are simulation models, micro-simulation models, they take household data that comes from census, and they use characteristics across households to calculate, essentially, the tax burdens that each household would face on different types of income. And so this is how CBO produces distributional estimates within the 10-year budget window. This is how Penn Wharton can calculate distributional effects as well, except that Penn Wharton then takes this micro simulation model and doesn't just stick to the 10-year window. It actually feeds the micro simulation results into the long-term macro model. And so what does that mean? It means that we're not just simulating, we're not just calculating household like tax bills, but we're also, because we're trying to project behavior that we don't see in any data set, we only see one point in time, right, from census data. We take the characteristics and then we send households on a path going forward into the future. And they make decisions like getting married, getting divorced, having children, deciding where to live, you know, moving to different parts of the country, emigrating, like leaving the country, coming into the country, having family come into the country. They make decisions about how much to work, how much to save in each year. And these are within a micro simulation model that characterizes like a whole lifetime's worth of decisions for households. And all of those decisions add up to aggregates that feed into the macro, long-term macroeconomic model. So everything is internally consistent. All our household-level calculations are consistent with all our macro variables that feed into and drive the long-term macro economy. And because of that, we can actually pull out the particular circumstances, the particular experiences of a representative household in our model. So we can start to tell stories about how a policy that has a certain effect in the long term and in aggregate affects a single household this way, affects a married household with four children this way. So we have the capability of making these economic models and the results that come out of the models a lot more real, like putting kind of a human face or human faces in our economic model. And I think that is the key to making these models more real for both policymakers and for the general public, to make them more understandable and more real so that it's no longer an abstract concept to talk about what a policy does. But people ultimately always want to know, what does this mean for me, or what does this mean for my constituents, or what does this mean to different groups of people where I care about the fairness of a policy, not just the effects on economic growth. And I think it's only then where we make these economic effects more real for people that they'll actually pay attention to the fiscal sustainability issue.
I'm looking forward to seeing the results of your work. You make a great point about how this can help put really a human face or a human element to a lot of the nation's fiscal challenges or economic challenges. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and senior advisor at the Penn Wharton Budget Model, Diane Lim. We discussed Diane's work at PWBM and their effort to make economic analysis and economists more useful to policymakers in real life. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob and Diane.
Thanks, Chase.
Up next, Bob and I will be joined on the show by Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at Americans for Prosperity, Allison Acosta Winters. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at Americans for Prosperity, Allison Acosta Winters. Allison also worked at the Heritage Foundation as a Senior Fellow and Director of State and Local Programs. She was also the Director of the Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at Heritage. During her time there, she participated in the fiscal wake-up tour with the Concord Coalition and other partners, and we're actually going to talk a little bit more about that today as well. Welcome to Facing the Future, Allison, and welcome back, Bob.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chase.
Happy to have you both on the show. I actually want to spend some time talking about your experience at AFP, Allison, your policy analysis on how to avert the nation's debt crisis, and your work way back when on the fiscal wake-up tour with the Concord Coalition. And I think before we dive into some of those topics headlong, just give a quick summary for our listeners of what you do with AFP and what AFP is even focused on right now.
Sure, thank you. First of all, I'm delighted to be with you. This feels like a kind of an old home situation here with all the work that we did together those years ago on the fiscal wake-up tour. For those of you, your listeners who are not familiar with us, Americans for Prosperity is a grassroots organization. We have state chapters in, I believe, 35 states now, but we have activists, millions of activists across the country in all 50 states. We're focused on a number of issues, including criminal justice reform, foreign policy, trade, something that I've worked in quite a bit, and as well as these economic kinds of issues like fiscal policy. So my role there as a senior policy fellow really is to look at these complex issues from tax policy to spending policy, entitlements, and so forth, and help us set the charge for policy changes that we think are going to make Americans, including the least fortunate, better off and more able to achieve success for themselves.
And Allison, I want to dive into your policy analysis from July about the spending and debt crisis and your take on that and some of your policy suggestions. But before we go that route, I want to give Bob a chance to reminisce, I think, on the fiscal wake-up tour. So maybe, Bob, you can give a quick recap for our listeners of what the fiscal wake-up tour was, and then Allison, you can jump in and share what your involvement was with it as well.
Well, Chase, it was right after the war, and we got...
Back in my day.
Back in the days when... this was an effort to bring fiscal sanity. So we had the fiscal wake-up tour, which generally took place between 2005 and 2010. And it consisted of Allison and colleagues from the Heritage Foundation, where she was then, and people from the Brookings Institution, and myself, and David Walker, who was then the Comptroller General of the United States. And the idea, the kind of the organizing principle of it, was that Dave and I would give numbers, and everybody agreed on. And then somebody from Brookings and somebody from Heritage, two well-known Washington think tanks, one is perceived as being, you know, more on the progressive side and the other more on the conservative side, would talk about solutions and how from different perspectives, analysts from different perspectives could look at the same set of numbers and say, okay, these are options and we could do them, you know, we could have a different mix of spending or revenues here. And audiences really liked it because they liked the fact that we would all agree on the numbers and then we would have a discussion about solutions that, you know, we didn't end up throwing things at each other or insulting one another or stuff like that. So it was very well received. We went on college campuses, and we did a lot of media, and I think we had some success, but the recession really got people's mind on other things. That was the fiscal wake-up tour.
And Allison, what role did you play? I think Bob referenced it earlier on, but can you give a little more detail on your involvement with the fiscal wake-up tour and whether you enjoyed yourself engaging in that kind of cross-country discussion with all other policy experts and audiences of, I guess, everyday voters?
Yeah, I really enjoyed our experience. So we had different participants, and the whole notion was you had somebody from a well-known organization on both the right and the left. So I think, you know, to Bob's point, Heritage and Brookings were the main drivers. And then we had, you know, sort of a non-partisan, non-ideological major figure in Dave Walker is the former comptroller. I guess he was comptroller general at the time.
He was, when most
started.
Of the time.
Yeah, most of the time he was. And then we had the Concord Coalition as, you know, sort of the honest broker in putting forward a safe venue to talk about these issues. What I found really refreshing was, you know, we came together from different perspectives because we all agreed that we had a big problem that we needed to have some solutions. So, you know, we had our areas of disagreement where we would look for different emphasis and solutions. But I felt like during the 5 years that we worked together in this project that we really had achieved some significant progress. We had great audiences. We had, you know, not only going on college campuses, but we also talked a lot with different business organizations. And I can remember one of the events that we did, I think it was in Denver. That was just a, you know, we went to Denver a couple of times, if I recall. The one I'm thinking of, we had a couple of former governors and the mayor of Denver.
John Hickenlooper.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yeah.
A name more in the news recently.
Yes. So we really were building up some good momentum, and I think unfortunately what definitely undid that was the financial crisis, the major policy responses to that. But now here we are, you know, a decade later, and everything that we were saying in the Fiscal Wake Up Tour is closer. Yet there's less concern among policymakers with where we're going and getting some serious solutions on the table to prevent that.
Yeah, let me pick up on that, too, because people sometimes say, I get this, I don't know whether you get it, but it's like, well, you people have been at this for so long and nothing ever happens, and I get a little bit frustrated because it almost did. We came very, very close in 2009, 2010, there was a consensus that something needed to be done. It wasn't just because of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, certainly, but we were contributing to that consensus. And, yeah, you think of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, and there was Alice Rivlin, our colleague on the Fiscal Wake Up Tour.
And
Pete Domenici, a Republican and Democrat, had something at bipartisan plans, and they came to a head around 2010 and failed. But it came close. I mean, in both instances, there was a failure of political will, I would say, on the part of the Obama administration, and I think it was more House Republicans that couldn't quite get over some of the differences. Plus you still had the recovery. So there was more of an argument about, you know, is this the time to be enacting fiscal things that might be contractionary rather than continuing to try to stimulate the economy. But it can be done. I mean, but what Allison said is very important, because we're now at a point several years later where it's almost like we have to start that process again. And I think, I can't speak for Americans for Prosperity, but from the Concord Coalition's point of view, recreating that sort of fiscal wake-up tour type environment where you have people taking stock of where we are and where we need to go and having serious conversations about that on a bipartisan basis is, you know, that's the hard work of just trying to rebuild.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely our perspective. And, you know, I think a lot of the work that we did on the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, helping, you know, voters, ordinary Americans, understand what is really driving our debt and deficits, both today and in the future, was a big, important part of the work that we did in particular. And my sense is we need to start that again. There's a lot of misinformation that's been, you might say, fake news. that has been foisted on Raiders, and so here we are, and now the Medicare trust fund is 7 years away from going broke, and the Social Security trust fund about 7 years after that. So I think the opportunity is that we're closer. When we were doing this a decade ago, it was, you know, a long time in the future. Well, we're not that far now. And so I think we do need to begin this work over again. One of the hallmarks of our organization and the larger community that we're a part of, Stand Together, is that we have really made a conscious effort to work with what we call non-traditional partners. So those are folks where we might not agree on every issue, but, you know, we agree that X is a problem. So one of the most prominent or well-known of those projects is our work that we've done in criminal justice reform, where we work with organizations that we wouldn't agree with on other issues. And I think there's a real role for that. And we've been successful. I think there's a role for that, again, in really explaining where we are with our fiscal situation before it becomes a crisis. Although it's hard not to argue that trillion-dollar deficits don't represent some proxy of a crisis.
We'd have fallen off our chairs on the fiscal wake-up tour thinking about deficits that large. But I just I know Chase wants to get into the issue brief, and I had, when I was reading it, the thought occurred to me, just as you were saying, that a lot of it is rebuilding that consensus around that there is a problem and what the nature of the problem is. And then we can have disagreements about what you do about it. But that consensus is really broken down. But one thing as you were talking that I was remembering, it was very successful as an educational device. Do you remember the simulator that you had? When Allison was at Heritage, there was this, a lot of us showed charts. And Allison had this fun little gadget that could show if you made various alterations to the budget outlook, what effect would it have on the projected deficit or debt? And for getting across to an audience what were the driving factors, it was very illustrative, because Allison would say, well, let's eliminate foreign aid and see what that does to the long-term picture. And she'd press the button and the line wouldn't move. So it was, you know, and let's eliminate the Pentagon. Let's eliminate defense. And the line would move, but, you know, it was still going up.
Right. It wouldn't solve the problem. And I think one of the things that was really aimed at is sort of myth-busting that you can do all this by cutting foreign aid and, you know, we just need to cut back the military and we don't need to touch entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So it was a different way of presenting exactly the same information that everybody else was presenting, but it was more of a kind of alive.
It moved.
Yeah, it moved.
It moved. Our charts didn't move. It was exciting.
And Bob, yeah. You're definitely right. I do want to jump in and get to the issue brief, but I sat back and listened to the description of the fiscal wake-up tour and what you were trying to accomplish there, because I think it's an important discussion that needs to be renewed, I think, today. And you mentioned a lot of things that I would normally have follow-up questions on, but one of the biggest challenges I think we face is one of the foundational principles of the fiscal wake-up tour, and that was having an agreed-upon set of facts, or at least fiscal facts, from which you could base, you know, policy solutions or proposals. And I think we're struggling with that today. So I think you're both right. It's high time and probably a little more urgency behind perhaps Fiscal Wake-Up Tour 2.0. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at Americans for Prosperity, Allison Acosta-Winters. And I think it's a good time to pivot to that policy analysis you issued in July, Allison. And unfortunately, we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left, so it's going to have to be a relatively high-level conversation of it. But give a rundown of what you were trying to accomplish with this report, and we can start jumping into some of the solutions you proposed.
Sure. Just really quickly, what we're trying to accomplish is exactly what we did on the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour, to take a nonpartisan set of numbers and explain them to the American people. So we spend last year about $4 trillion. We took in about $3.3 trillion in taxes. We had a massive deficit, and we're now about $22 trillion in debt. So then taking those numbers, boiling that down for ordinary Americans, in other words, for every household in America, we spent, the federal government only, spent $32,000, taxed $26,000, a deficit of $6,000, and a national debt of $168,000. So again, trying to break this down for ordinary Americans, trying to get them to understand what's driving the problem, how waste, fraud, and abuse contribute to it, how foreign aid contributes to it, what kind of good governance solutions could we have, how much those could be expected to save. All those are important and good things to do. And as we used to say, everything should be on the table, but those alone aren't enough to tackle our problem driven by Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. One of the other things that we wanted our readers to understand is that this alone, or these programs, it's not just a number situation. I mean, clearly the numbers are important, but there's flaws in the programs themselves. So for one thing, Social Security, for example, is a part of it is an anti-poverty program for retirees, yet you have millions of seniors who are still living in retirement despite, you know, Social Security benefits. So we need to be thinking about what are these programs really designed to do? What do we want them to do in the future as we think about also making them affordable?
And Allison, you mentioned what I would consider the big three, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and acknowledge that growth in those programs are big drivers in the federal budget and the growth of deficits and the debt. What proposals did you put on the table for reforming those programs, and why did you make the policy proposals you did compared to perhaps some others that may be popular from either party's perspective?
Yeah, sure. So from my perspective, my view is that this really is a spending problem. Taxes might be part of an ultimate solution, but I want to focus in on what is the biggest driver of our fiscal imbalance, and that is these entitlement programs. So we wanted to do a couple things. We want them to be affordable and sustainable. We want them to be fair for seniors, but we also want them to be fair for taxpayers both today and in the future. So there's a couple things, ideas that have been around since our fiscal wake-up tour time that still make sense today. We're living longer. Personally, the older I get, the better news I think that is. But we ought to have those programs, Social Security and Medicare in particular, reflect that reality. We should increase the retirement age and then index it to longevity so that we don't have to periodically revisit this as an issue for America. Another thing, and this is really kind of a big idea since we're running a little bit short on time, is to think about who do we want these benefits to flow to the most? Do we want them to flow to high-income Americans, or do we really want to focus them on those who need them the most? And our proposal is, let's begin to think about putting more emphasis. This already exists in both Social Security and Medicare. Let's think about putting more emphasis on people who have the least ability to save for retirement. So we would prioritize resources for both Social Security and Medicare more on lower earners, and there's different ways to do this, but we would do it through a variety of different kind of income adjusting. One of the things for Social Security we would also do is to increase that minimum benefit. So we really want to focus on anti-poverty. We really want seniors who need this the most to get it. And those who are more well off shouldn't have, as high benefits, it necessitating larger tax increases for working families.
Allison, I wish we had more time because I think we could spend another whole show diving into this proposal and getting more granular. We'll have to have you back soon so that we can talk more about the specific policy proposals, maybe get into the revenue and tax side with a little more detail. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at Americans for Prosperity, Allison Acosta Winters. We discussed Allison's experience at AFP, her involvement in the fiscal wake-up tour, and recent policy analysis on how to avert the nation's debt crisis. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Allison.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.